From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Scott Tong. It's Here and Now. If you're vaccinated, it may soon be time for another shot in the arm. This morning, the U.S. government recommended a booster for people who got the Pfizer or Moderna shots. The idea here is to wait 8 months after your second dose. And the program starts in a month or so. Here's Surgeon General Vivek Murthy.
Having reviewed the most current data, it is now our clinical judgment that the time to lay out a plan for COVID-19 boosters is now. Recent data makes clear that protection against mild and moderate disease has decreased over time. This is likely due to both waning immunity and the strength of the widespread Delta variant.
And for more, Dr. Peter Hotez joins us again. He's Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston and co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital. Dr. Hotez, third booster shot 8 months later. Good idea?
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be necessary. And, you know, one of the things that I've been trying to do is reframe this a little bit to provide some reassurance, because I think people are thinking that something bad has happened, that things have derailed or something's gone wrong.
Yeah, right. Suddenly I'm at risk again. Whoa, right?
Yeah, and it's really not the case. In some ways, this was by design. And the reason I say that is, if you remember when these vaccines were released back in December and January, it had a 3 to 4 week interval between the first or second dose, depending on whether it was Pfizer or Moderna. And that's pretty unusual for a vaccine schedule. Usually, if you want to produce long-term durable protection, you would separate out for a much longer period, maybe at least 6 months. The reason they did that was because at that time, if you remember, we were losing 3,000 Americans a day. And we need to fully vaccinate the American people as quickly as possible. That was the reason for the urgency. But almost by design, it meant that we're going to have a booster later on, either whether it's 6 months later or a year later. So this is all predicted and predictable. And I think they could have reframed that a little bit to emphasize that point.
But as you're saying, we knew there was this trade-off to front load the shots, and then eventually we might come to this question. Now, what do you make of the data here? Do we have enough data in your view to make this call?
Well, what they've seen now is a slippage in the level of protection against infection, both in data from Israel and some from the United States now. And I think there's going to be more data put up on the CDC website from the MMR data report coming up soon. And it basically says that the efficacy against infections going down from over 90% to 40 to 50%, maybe a little better for the Moderna vaccine. And even though the published data has not shown us a breakthrough hospitalizations, there's an anticipation that that's going to happen. And anecdotally, we've already heard that from a number of people, that they're seeing a significant percentage of hospitalized individuals who have been vaccinated. And so that's the reason for calling for the boost. I think if they knew it was only going to be infection, not hospitalization, they might have held off. But I think the concern is that there was enough there that they thought this was the tip of the spear.
All right. Now this relates to people who got the Pfizer and Moderna shots. 13 million Americans got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. They're not included here. Why not?
Yeah, and this has been a constant source of frustration from my side as well, that the communications have always lagged behind from the J&J vaccine. They almost talk about it like an afterthought, which is too bad, because it's a good vaccine. By the way, it was developed initially in Boston, where you are, by Dan Baruch's lab at Harvard Medical School. And I think we don't have a lot of data. And again, it's partly because we rely so heavily on data from Israel rather than our own U.S. CDC, that what happened is the J&J vaccine has not been deployed in Israel, so that's why we don't have it. So I think that will be forthcoming as well. And I think, you know, if you looked at that phase one, phase two data, I think you could have seen that we're probably going to need either a second dose of the J&J vaccine or boosting with one of the mRNA vaccines, Moderna or Pfizer. I just don't know what's in the cards in terms of what they're going to recommend.
All right. And very quickly, we always have to ask the supply question here. If we do this for the Americans, is there enough for the rest of the world?
Yeah, I think this has never been framed very well, and it takes a longer. We could do a whole half an hour show just on what's needed, but the point is
tomorrow
we have 1 billion people in Africa, 650 million people in Latin America. We have 500 million people in the smaller low-income countries of Southeast Asia, 2 to 3 billion people. We need 6 billion doses, and the U.S. government needs to come clean and come up with a plan for providing 6 billion doses. We think our vaccine at Texas Children's is part of the answer, that it's a low-cost vaccine now being scaled in India and Indonesia, simple, easy to produce, scale, no upper limit, but we're not getting any help from the U.S. government, unfortunately, about that one.
Dr. Peter Hotez of Texas Children and the Baylor College of Medicine. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks so much.
Well, in Afghanistan today, people desperately trying to leave that country are still trying to reach the Kabul airport. The Taliban controls the country except for the airport, which American troops have secured, although the Taliban is right outside it and has reportedly fired shots and used physical force against people gathered there. As we've become acutely aware, the situation is especially dire for Afghans who worked with the U.S. government or press or aid groups. Tens of thousands are seeking special visas. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman is here. And Tom, you've reported from there, you know, for over 20 years. What are you hearing from or about people trying to get out?
Well, a couple of our colleagues, Afghans, are trying to get out there, hunkered down in Kabul itself. They tried to get to the airport today. It was impossible. There are huge crowds in the streets. You have to go through Taliban checkpoints. And one of our colleagues tried to get to the airport with his two young children and his wife. They had all their luggage, and they saw the Taliban beating these women at a checkpoint. He got really afraid, and this guy is pretty tough. So he left all his luggage with all his money in it and went back into the city. So those scenes are continuing to today. You know, again, hard to get to the airport. Right. Taliban checkpoints are being set up. It's an awful scene.
Well,
today.
And there are reports of Americans or, as you said, Afghan allies trying to get out who aren't in Kabul. And one wonders, how would they get to Kabul? Because they'd have to travel through Taliban checkpoints.
Right. I mean, it's possible they could get to Kabul from, let's say, Kandahar or Mazar-e-Sharif. But you're right. I mean, the Taliban control those cities now. So can you get out of the city if you have a car? You're going to go through multiple checkpoints with Taliban. It's going to be difficult, if not impossible, for them to get out. And weeks ago, I talked to an officer in the Pentagon. He said, you know, there's nothing we can do to help them. You know, we're leaving the country. We're now based in Kabul. We're not around the country, so we can't transport them from some of these cities back into Kabul. It's tragic.
You send them a visa, but if they have it and a Taliban fighter finds it, that would be trouble.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yesterday, Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said that the U.S. is trying to evacuate everyone before August 31st. Now, I know you asked, is that an arbitrary date? Can the president change that? They said to you, only the president can change that. Do you have any sense since then if President Biden will change that date or if it can get done by the 31st?
It's hard to imagine it's going to get done by the 31st. I estimated 100,000 people trying to get out. It could be many more than that. That's just a guess. And yeah, John Kirby said it's up to the White House. It is an arbitrary deadline. The president said it. The president can change that and say, listen, we're going to go well into September, maybe beyond, to make sure everybody gets out of the city. But Robin, here's the problem. Mm-hmm. The Americans control the airport, and more troops are flowing in to make sure it's secure. It's still not 100% secure. They're not out in the streets. The streets are owned by the Taliban. Now, U.S. officials say the Taliban have given assurances that safe passage will be given for Afghans to get to the airport. But at this point, we have not seen that. So that's the real problem. Mm. I mean, if they can get to the airport, it would be better. And then you have the added problem of, do you have the documentation? There was a video just this morning of British soldiers pushing away Afghan families because they didn't have the proper paperwork. That's been a problem all along. Mm. To apply for some of these visas is very laborious. You have to have recommendations. You have to have a security check. You have to have a medical exam and all of these things. One guy told me, you know, it's like, you know, getting your license at the DMV. He said, this is a DMV on steroids.
Yeah. Everyone can relate to that. Look, John Kirby also said that there were Afghan soldiers providing security at the airport, which was surprising because we thought all of them had put down their arms and fled. And some would say that's understandable. But he said that those soldiers could also apply for visas if they wanted to get out. That was surprising even to Pentagon officials. What's been the reaction to that?
Well, on Twitter, I posted that on Twitter, and I got 100 responses. People are outraged by that. But you know, we'll have to see what happens. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and General Mark Milley, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, they're going out today, and I hope to ask them about that. What happens to these soldiers? Do they get a special way out, or do they have to apply for a visa? Here's the other thing, Robin. Who do they apply to?
Yeah.
There's a skeleton staff at the embassy, at the airport. How do they even apply, even if they wanted to? It's horrible.
DMV on steroids will stay with me. And NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman, you'll be back, I know. And we just want to say, we know it's very hard for you and others, knowing you have colleagues there. So thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
And a clean start, lane number three, a great start for David Brown and Jerome Avery. David Brown and Jerome Avery, it will be Team Bravery coming to the line and getting the gold.
That's Paralympic gold medalist David Brown at the 2016 Para-Athletics Championships in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, running with his sighted guide partner, Jerome Avery, because David is blind. He won the gold medal and ran 10.99 seconds in the men's 100-meter dash to break the Paralympic record. He's also set new world records in the 100 and 200 meters and is preparing to race for Team USA at the Tokyo, Japan Olympics next week. And again, he won't be running alone. His sighted partner this time will be Moray Stewart. David Brown, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
And Moray Stewart, you're there as well?
Yes, I am.
And Moray, I'm going to ask you to do as you usually do, stand by for a second while we speak to David, because David, you're used to that. David, we understand this all started as a child. You had Kawasaki disease, glaucoma, lost an eye, lost your vision at 13 and went to the Missouri School of the Blind. Can you just take us into your world for a second? What was that like? You weren't born blind. You lost your sight. That must have been frightening.
It is a very frightening thing because I was super light sensitive. That's one thing. But not only did the light scare me, the darkness scared me too, because I couldn't see what was in the dark. I was afraid to even go outdoors at one point, and terrified of my attic, terrified of my basement because it was dark. And I was living in fear for a number of years. It was pretty crazy for that time.
Well, it sounds like one of the things that got you outside was running with a runner's guide wire, which we understand is like a clothesline that's strung.
What got me outside actually was I was 6 years old, and my vision started decreasing in my right eye by this point. You know, I lost my left eye when I was 3 years old due to eye surgery. At that point, when I was 6 years old, I just had a hole in my eye. I didn't have a prosthetic shell until I was 9. So I was living with a hole in my left eye for 3 years. 6 years old, I was playing basketball, but all of a sudden I started getting hit in the face with the ball. I couldn't see the ball coming. And I took that opportunity one day to run on the playground, and I realized, you know, I had some speed there. So when I was at the Missouri School for the Blind in St. Louis, Missouri, when I moved there, I was 11 years old, and that exposed me to track, man. Running on this wire, you know, I had to hold on to like this clothesline looking thing and pretty much pump one arm and run as fast as I could for 60 meters. That's what kept me in a straight line, you know?
Well, but it got you going, and it felt good, and it could vent some of your, we understand, some of your fears and frustrations. So jumping ahead, you start actually running and start, you know, running with partners to be a Paralympian, to be a para-athlete. Our friend Peter Sagal, who hosts the show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, he's a guide for blind runners in the marathon. How do you run with someone? What are the things you have to think about there?
Backtracking a little bit, actually. So 11 years old, you start running. Now, all of a sudden, you realize, okay, yeah, you can start sprinting and competing against other people. So I'm going through these different competitions and learning more about guiding and stuff like that. It was Beijing, China, actually. I was selected to attend the games and witness that live. That was from me being selected after submitting an essay.
Well, you wrote an essay for a contest to attend the 2008 Paralympic Games in Beijing. You won and got to go sit in the bird's nest and see the Olympics. And it sounds like that sealed it for you. What do you think you said in that essay?
There was 25 athletes that they took. No, I was selected out of 100 of applicants. And that, no, that was humbling in itself. And what I did say in that that essay, it was how sports has impacted me up into that point. How I utilized sport to help me get through a lot of obstacles that I was facing with up until the age of 15. You know, I was suffering from a lot of depression. I wanted to commit suicide at one point. You know, overcoming those fears that I had of going outside, and my essay was selected. You know, after witnessing those games, I was like, you know what, this is possible. So let's work towards this. You know, and that's when I started pushing towards going forward towards the London Games.
Okay, so I want to bring in Moray in a second, but so now you have to learn to, you know, come off the blocks with someone at the same. It's just like you and your shadow, right? You have to be in sync. Your footfall has to be. You have to run in a straight line. What are some of the things you have to think about and work on with a partner? How do you get in sync?
Honestly, like, I didn't learn how to run straight really until last year. So if you're not running in a straight line, that can take off time. If I'm running in, if I'm running out, if I'm going left, if I'm going right, that all plays a factor.
Well, let's bring in Moray Stewart, your cited co-runner. And Moray, I mean, as we heard at the top of the segment, you know, in 2016, David and his then partner, Jerome Avery, won the gold in the 100-meter dash. And you've had to forge a new relationship, a little pressure going to the Paralympics?
I would say not really so much pressure. I don't know if that's because it's my first time going, because I had never been. Maybe when I get there, I'll maybe feel some pressure. But right now, I'm just kind of like ready and just staying focused and working and then doing what I have to do, go take care of business out there. So, yeah, that's what I would say.
Well, what is that business, Moray? Because David was talking about how he's, you know, got to get the arms pumping together, got to get off the blocks. What do you do? This is not a marathon. We know Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's a guide for the blind for, you know, 26 miles. You got 10, 11 seconds. What do you have to think about?
The only thing I would say I would really think about is just keeping them straight and running fast. I don't really think as much. I just think about getting out, accelerating, just keeping them straight. And next thing you know, 10-second race is over just in a flash. So,
yeah. We know you're tethered by a piece of fabric at the hands, wrapped around your fingers. How do you guide while you're going?
When we're guiding, yeah, the tether is hooked to our hands. So we're basically running, we're pumping our arms the same and everything. Like sometimes we do like starts separately, and David runs pretty straight. Sometimes he run, maybe take up just two lanes. Sometimes he just take up like running just one lane. So, and then you attach a guide to him, it makes it way much easier. We go way much faster. So he also, helps me a lot. Just learning how to run by itself.
Moray, do you have to be careful? I know in long distance guides have to think about this, but are you running running as fast as you can? And do you have to be careful, you know, either to keep up with David or not get a little ahead of him?
I run pretty fast with David. You know, I don't really have to slow down as much, you know, like my, because David is pretty fast, so I don't have to slow down as much.
Well, and Moray, you're a darn good runner in your own right. But David's the one for whom there's a lot at stake here. How important is this to you? What kind of a responsibility do you feel not to trip, not to, you know, to help him get to that podium?
Yeah, it is a lot. But like I said, you know, it's my first time. So I don't really think about like that's when I think people start to focus on like the what ifs that, you know, like they're kind of throwing their mind off. But if you just stay focused, like, you know, we're going to go out here, we're going to win. You know, if you stay confident like that, I feel like that's what's going to, you know, get us through and get us the, you know, do what we have to do. So,
yeah. Do you call out anything? It's, again, it's only 11 seconds in that 100 yard dash. It's more in the 200. But do you say anything?
I do say a few things when we're running, like usually when we get out the blocks, you know what I'm saying? Like drive, you know, and then when to accelerate, you know, and I say like usually halfway. And after the halfway, I'm going to say like 25. And then he knows, you know, he wants to lean. I don't speak too much during the race, because when you're running, like usually when you're running fast, the people who are doing like a lot of talking, you know, you're not running as fast because you're focused on talking to them, but they know kind of what to do. And so, you know, so you have to say like only like a few things, you know?
Boy, David Brown, how important is this partnership and what it allows you to do?
Honestly, just like any blind athlete, you know, to have a guide beside you is very vital to what we do, because we can't do this without, you know, guys like Murray, guys like Jerome. And I'll fully understand if this guy, you know, were to be like, look, man, you know, I want to just do my own thing. But, you know, here he is running with me, you know, and it's a big, you know, it's a great honor.
Yeah. Well, we understand you also feel you have another running partner, but one maybe we all can't see.
Yeah, my hashtag is running for his glory. And that's referring to God, you know, firm believer in Jesus Christ. And it's what I hold to true all the time.
Yeah. Hey, I don't think I know the answer to this, and I should, but when you win, and David Brown, mm-hmm. we have faith in you, do you both take the podium?
Yeah, so as of 2012, the guides get medals. So 2016 was, well, of course, my first time getting a gold medal. And the guide runner that I ran with or compete with got a medal as well. And hopefully one day we can get this guy a medal as well, you know, Murray. Hopefully this year, you know, so yeah. We'll see.
I hope it's soon. David Brown, two-time Paralympian, world record holder for his division in the 100-meter dash, and his guide runner, Murray Stewart, both going to be in Tokyo next week. David, Murray, all the best to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I know I'll be watching.
NPR's Planet Money Summer School is back. This season is all about investing. We've got stories of big bets, bubble spotting, and cute animals, too. Every Wednesday till Labor Day from NPR's Planet Money.
If your family is like mine, you compete for masks. That is, who gets to wear the nicest ones out of the house. Well, get used to it. The TSA has extended its requirement for travel masks on trains, planes, buses until next January, which means America's debate over masks will go on. Let's put all that to Seth Kaplan, our transportation analyst at Here and Now. And Seth, these mask rules are because of the Delta variant raging across America. Are these COVID numbers hurting air travel?
Well, the early indication is yes, at least travel demand, people booking for trips in the future. Right now, a lot of people are still traveling. Mm. And these are trips that people in many cases booked earlier in the summer and have decided to take anyway. Airlines have said that they've seen some softening. You know, during the whole pandemic, whatever's been happening with COVID itself, you could follow that and, you know, track it with the airline booking numbers, and that's happening again now, but nowhere near what happened last year when almost nobody was traveling.
Now, I've been traveling 3 flights in the last couple of weeks. Don't know what you've seen, but as far as masks here, I've seen everybody on the plane in compliance. What does that look like now, and what will enforcement look like with these new TSA rules?
Yeah, and this is an extension of rules that have existed. We've seen those well-publicized incidents of people not following the rules. Thankfully, those are, of course, a minority of flights. I, too, have been on several flights, never seen anything like that. But yes, it is happening more often than in the past that you have these conflicts, at least reported conflicts, with flight attendants. There could have been incidents in the past that weren't reported to the same degree that they are now, but every indication is that, you do have more of this happening. And now, at least, as you said, through January, those same rules are going to apply also on public transportation.
Now, in the not following category, let's talk a little about air rage and duct tape. Frontier's airline flight staff, as you know, had to tape down a man who allegedly punched flight attendants. American Airlines staff had to do the same thing with an unruly female passenger. You know, perhaps an effective use of an all-purpose adhesive. But going forward, what options do the airlines have for this?
United, in fact, Scott, has gone out of its way to tell its employees that duct tape is not to be used for this purpose. Hard to believe that we're even having this conversation, right? But look, these are flight attendants who, if you look at the videos that have come out on social media, you could understand why in some cases they were concerned. And so it's all a question about getting the balance right in terms of what to do about these passengers. Remember, too, alcohol is still not served on board. So, you know, if you're confusing causation and correlation, maybe you'd say, well, why is everybody so unruly now that there's less alcohol? Probably no connection there, but everything's so different now from how it used to be.
And finally, just as far as unruly events on airplanes, are there still those air marshals on the planes? I remember after 9/11, these security professionals were on all the planes.
Yeah, for a while, all flights, or at least that's what we were told, then sort of sporadically on domestic flights and on most international flights. Mm-hmm. There are a few thousand of them in the U.S. still. TSA is cagey about, you know, saying where they actually are for obvious security reasons. But if you do the math, that tells you that they're not on nearly every flight. And we've seen these incidents, at least as far as anybody could tell, mm-hmm. they haven't been able to respond.
Probably duct tape rules for them, too. That is Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Nearly two decades ago, a black woman named Kalisha White applied for a team leader position at Target and worried that her application had been ignored because of her race. So she sent it back in with the name Sarah White and slightly fewer qualifications and got an interview. Eventually, she won a class action lawsuit against Target. 20 years later, a new study shows not much has changed. Economists from University of California, Berkeley, and University of Chicago conducted what they called a discrimination audit, sending 83,000 job applications to 108 companies, some applications with traditionally white-sounding names, some with distinctive black-sounding names. And they found, well, we're joined by Berkeley economist Patrick Klein, one of the study's authors. Professor Klein, what did you find?
Well, what we found was that applications with distinctively black names were called back about 10% less often than their white counterparts, despite having characteristics that are otherwise the same as those white applications.
I want to talk a little bit about the applications because I'm sure people are wondering, well, 10%, maybe there's some other reason for this. So let's talk about the applications. What was on them? How'd you set up the study?
So we put a lot of work into creating applications that would look realistic. So if you apply to a job posted by a major company these days, you'll have to fill out your employment history. You might have to take a personality test. We automated that entire process. And we eventually had bots fill out all of those fields. And then we also created a resume that was uploaded for every applicant wherever we were able to. And to our knowledge, we actually have the highest response rate that's ever been garnered from one of these studies.
And what were some of the names that were the white names or the black names?
So the white names were names that are very common, like Emily or Greg. And examples of black names would be Jamal or Lakeisha. These are names that most people recognize as being distinctively white or distinctively black.
Yeah, and we're going to rush to say that we know that there are black Americans that are named William, you know, or John.
Yes.
I mean, this was just a way of trying to get at what discrimination there might be. And you said, on average, the applications from candidates with the black names had fewer responses. Did you do any follow-up with those companies and ask any of those people why this application over that application?
No, we haven't reached out to the companies yet. Our guess is that they would have a hard time answering the question of why did you favor this applicant over this other applicant? And the reason is because these are major companies that were selected because they have a national employment footprint. So we sampled these companies from the Fortune 500 companies. Companies like this, the hiring decisions are spread all throughout the country. And despite having very sophisticated screening algorithms and application portals that in many cases are outsourced to third parties, ultimately these questions come down to the decision of some human somewhere. In fact, one of our key findings was that discrimination is actually more prevalent at companies where more phone numbers called us back, which we interpret as a measure of the decentralization of the hiring process. So suppose that company A called us back 100 times. Were we contacted by 100 distinct phone numbers? That would be extreme decentralization. Or were we only contacted by 5 different phone numbers? If each contact was a different phone number, that was a very strong predictor of discrimination against black names. What we think is going on here is that some places have different hiring practices than others. In some places, it's not very internally regulated by HR practices. So whoever's maybe working a shift at that restaurant that day can sift through the applications and just decide who they want to call in for an interview next week. At other places, there's more hoops that you have to jump through before you can decide to call someone back. Maybe you have to run it against a few other people. And at those places, there seems to be less discrimination.
Right. And we know that in some parts of the business world, there's an effort to look for diversity. So if it's a trained HR person, they may be more likely to do that and to realize they're just a bias they didn't even know they had and to maybe override that. I mean, we don't
exactly.
know. Yeah, yeah. But you briefed the Department of Labor on the findings. What did they say?
Well, I can't share exactly what they said, but I think there was a lot of interest in seeing a scientific measure of discrimination. Testing for discrimination is very difficult, right? And so legal battles over discrimination are often very contentious because companies will often be investigated for discrimination based upon a single complaint. And a key piece of evidence might be that a company has a very low fraction of some protected group, say African-Americans or women. But when you see a very low employment share, you don't really know whether that low employment share is arising because of discrimination or because of something else. It could be that not many people applied to that job, or the qualifications of people applying to the job is different across groups. Here, everything else was held constant. And so these patterns by sector and for particular companies are telling us that discrimination is actually much more concentrated than the previous literature had been able to measure. Roughly half of the callbacks lost due to discrimination in our experiment were accounted for by the top 20% of discriminating firms. And that came as a surprise to us, and it's perhaps an optimistic message, actually. It suggests that this isn't really a needle in the haystack problem. And it seems possible that perhaps by imitating the best practices of the companies that are doing a good job in terms of bias, that the 20% of companies that seem to be doing a very bad job can get their act together and provide a more equitable and inclusive workplace.
We know you spoke to the Labor Department. You can't tell us too much about that conversation, except you did share with them which industries you found this in the most. Where did you see this?
Discrimination against Black names was most prevalent in the auto services and dealer sector. In general, discrimination tended to be concentrated in customer-facing sectors like retail and apparel, eating establishments. There was much less discrimination in more what you might think of as back office type jobs and industry. So for instance, freight and transport sector had very low levels of discrimination against Black names. For gender, we actually found discrimination against men was prevalent in the apparel sector, whereas we found discrimination against women was prevalent in the heavier industries like the auto sector.
But again, the thing maybe we don't know is why it's happening. It could just be a bias that that company's not even aware of, that training to overcome that bias could maybe change that company's perception. It could be that the company is racist. And yet the thing we do seem to know from this is that not much has changed. I mean, you have Kalisha White doing her own experiment with Target and winning a lawsuit then. And there was also another paper more than a decade ago from the University of Chicago, your partner in this research, which looked at applicants in just Boston and Chicago and found candidates named Emily or Greg did better than applicants named Lakeisha or Jamal. Were you surprised to find pretty much the same thing so many years later?
It's true, and in one sense, it's depressing. I think what is quite new here is being able to figure out whether that's just some ambient level of background implicit bias endemic in our society, or whether it's really something that is concentrated in a few bad actors. And one read of what we're finding is that it's extremely concentrated. And that suggests that maybe the bad actors can be turned into good actors by following company-specific policies and practices like HR policies, having somebody else sign off on your decisions instead of allowing the local manager to have complete discretion might be a way of dealing with fundamental biases that are hard to directly attack.
Yeah. That's University of California, Berkeley professor Patrick Klein, one of the authors of a study along with researchers from the University of Chicago, a discrimination audit sending 83,000 job applications to 108 companies, some with white names, some with distinctive black names, and finding that the response to the resumes and job applications was about 10% less for the black name applicants. Professor Klein, thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
The Taliban last ruled Afghanistan in the early 2000s, and many of us recall horrific scenes of public executions in soccer stadiums, full-body burqas for women. But at a press conference yesterday, the Taliban of 2021 tried to strike a new tone. No to revenge attacks on Western collaborators, and yes to women's rights within the bounds of Islamic law. That is what they say. What they're doing is already firing on Afghan protesters and beating people en route to the airport. So, have the Taliban changed? Might it? Thomas Rutij is with the Afghanistan Analyst Network, where he's co-director and senior analyst. And Thomas, welcome to Here and Now.
Yeah, hi, Scott.
Hi there. Let's start with this press conference in Kabul yesterday. Any signals to you of an enlightened Taliban, as it were?
Well, yeah, the Taliban have been working on that for a long time. They have learned, I think, since last time they lost power in Afghanistan, of course, because of the terrorist attacks on 9/11, but also after isolation from the international community for many years because of their repressive regime, that they cannot alienate the international community and the entire Afghan population at the same time. Mm. So they're trying to make gestures towards them.
I see. So that is the international community matters to them. The people at home, of course, matter to the Taliban. Let's spin back first to 1996 briefly. Can you remind us what big change the Taliban brought when they took control?
Well, in the beginning, when they took control, that's between 1994, when the movement was established, until 1996, Kabul was taken. They first ended a civil or factional war, which had broken out after the Soviets had left the country after their invasion. And the Taliban, actually, former Mujahideen, came and tried to end that by disarming all those factions, and they succeeded to a large extent.
And then, of course, we saw on the screens some horrific footage of public executions, etc. From what we saw of the Taliban rule in the 90s, does it suggest that there might be certain non-negotiables for the Taliban going forward?
Yeah, I mean, what they also said yesterday at the first press conference in Kabul is that their ideology, their belief in Islamic values has not changed, and that's actually the fact. But the Taliban's also a political movement, and they need to adapt to the political environment, and I think they're trying to do that. It's easy to believe why people in Afghanistan do not believe that, because they still have the experience from the years before 2001 with these harsh measures,
sure.
Public issues. And so on.
Right. No, of course, I can imagine someone on the streets being so terrified now. The political environment, let me ask you what you learned as a scholar about how it changed when the Taliban were in the wilderness, as it were, the last 20 years. What did they learn about how to evolve, about how to innovate in order to stay in power in the pockets of Afghanistan and Pakistan where they were?
Yeah, and increasing pockets over the years. I mean, they actually evolved from a guerrilla movement into a parallel government with at least embryonic government structures, and tried to cater to needs of the people, running schools and clinics. Mm.
And so then now that they're back in power, are these questions of the social contract important to ask? Surely they're, you know, the people of Afghanistan will be thinking about this, that, you know, can they provide us with perhaps basic level of services in order to live?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the questions Afghans have. And the Taliban have tried to respond to that in those areas they have been controlling. That was seen as positive by a large population of the people, not because they love the Taliban and their way of how they rule so much, but because they are just sick and tired of 40 years war and are happy when the war is ending and regardless who's running the country. But also, I mean, there's a lack of a political and military alternatives inside Afghanistan to them. So I think a lot of the people in Afghanistan will need to accommodate themselves with them.
Yep. And so going forward, can you provide maybe two versions of what daily life might be for a family in Afghanistan, a more optimistic version, quote unquote, and a different one?
Mm. Yeah, it's really too early to say in which direction it will go. I mean, one version or one scenario would be that the situation settles down, at least the war ends and the Taliban really start thinking politically and more constructively about rebuilding the country and also reaching out to the international community because they will need external resources for that. And the other version would be they just show us a nicer face currently, and when the attention of the world turns away, they're falling back into old repressive practices. The danger is that they do it in hiding, but of course the world also has changed. And they're all kind of people around with mobile phone cameras. So we will hear about it and keep up the pressure on the Taliban not to relapse into that scenario.
Thomas Rutich is co-director and senior analyst at the Afghanistan Analyst Network, and he connected to us by Skype. Thomas, thanks so much for your time.
I thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.